It's Friday, November 1st, 2013. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. An absolutely stunning article was released yesterday by the Indianapolis Star. The headline is this: In same-sex couple dispute, Indiana Court of Appeals calls for lawmakers to refine definition of parent. What exactly constitutes a parent, asked the reporter in this case. Is parenthood determined solely by a biological tie, or can it be defined by a commitment to bring a child into the world and raise that child as your own? This is an important question, but it's not really in this case being raised by the reporter. Rather, it's being raised by the Court of Appeals of the state of Indiana. Even as that court calls upon the Indiana State Legislature to decide the issue by defining anew what it means to be a parent. Reporter Tim Evans explains that there are no clear answers to the question of parenthood in Indiana at present, at least in Indiana law, and that, legal scholars say, is leaving a growing number of who's your children in limbo. Of course, what's being discussed here, by the way, is the fact that even as this article says, and the reporter claims that there are no clear answers in Indiana law, actually there are answers if you limit the definition of family and parenthood to the traditional biological family and, of course, to the legal concept of adoption. But what we're talking about here is far outside of those categories. We're talking about same-sex couples, single persons who may be using assisted reproduction, and others who are generally classified as being in a non-traditional family. As Evans goes on to explain, yesterday the Indiana Court of Appeals handed down a decision in a same-sex couple's child custody dispute. However, we need to note that in this case, the decision really wasn't much of a decision. Instead, the court punted the issue back to the state's legislature, renewing a previous call made by the court for direction from lawmakers. As Judge Ezra H. Friedlander wrote in the opinion, quote, "What began as a trickle is rapidly becoming a torrent, and the number of children whose lives are impacted by rules that have yet to be written only increases with the passage of time. They and we," he said, "would welcome a legislative roadmap to help navigate the novel legal landscape in which we have arrived," end quote. There is fascinating language embedded within the judge's statement, such as the novel legal landscape, and, of course, his very poetic statement that what began as a trickle is now becoming a torrent. As Evans explains, without clear direction from the Indiana legislature, legal experts say that the courts will go on to struggle to resolve an influx of visitation, custody, and support cases involving children from same-sex and other non-traditional families. The specific non-traditional family at issue in the case yesterday was a lesbian couple. They had had a child by some means not described in the article. One of the partners had legal parenthood, the other did not. Once the relationship was severed, the partner without the parenthood rights sued in order to gain access to the child and visitation rights. What the court effectively said yesterday, this Indiana Court of Appeals, was that Indiana law at present defines parenthood in very traditional ways. Thus, as the judge said, the court was not freed by the legislature and its laws in this case, to decide on its own what was in the best interest of the child. This is a very interesting legal development in Indiana, but this is not only about the state of Indiana. Similar cases are piling up just about everywhere, and in some states that already have, for instance, civil unions or other forms of same-sex legal relationships, these issues may already have been significantly redefined. In the decision handed down yesterday, the judges said, quote, "We encourage the Indiana legislature to help us address this current social reality by enacting laws to protect children who, through no choice of their own, find themselves born into unconventional familial settings," end quote. Note carefully the language in the decision referring to unconventional familial settings is pointing to those non-traditional families. Jennifer Droback, a professor at the Indiana University Robert H. McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis, said that Indiana is behind the curve in addressing the changing nature of families. She then went on to say, quote, "Less than 25% of Indiana families are Ozzie and Harriet families. If we keep using an early 20th century definition of families, we are grossly underserving our families and our children," end quote. Couple of interesting footnotes to her statement there. Note that this law professor is suggesting that the state's legislature should do exactly what the courts have here asked it to do, redefine the family and parenthood. She also, we should note, is citing the 2010 U.S. Census when she says that only 25%, indeed less than 25% of Indiana families are what she describes as, quote, Ozzie and Harriet families, end quote. By that designation, no doubt, she intends to point to two-parent, conventional, traditional families with a mother and a father married to each other and with children living within the home under the age of 18. What we need to note here is that this is a bit of scholastic or academic sleight of hand. At any given time, this doesn't mean that the family units that are counted in the 2010 census were not at one point such families, just not now. Given the long age span and the fact that children tend to grow up and leave the home, the reality is that at any given time, probably a minority of households, as legally established and defined by the Census Bureau, would be, to use her term here, intended to make it sound antiquated, an Ozzie and Harriet family. This is just one of the issues that is raised not only by the advent of legal same-sex marriage, which isn't even legal yet in the state of Indiana, but by the larger sexual revolution, by the marginalization of marriage, the redefinition of marriage even as you have the separation of marriage and procreation on the one hand and of procreation and marriage on the other. This is the inevitable result of the revolution in technology for reproduction and, of course, assisted reproduction. The definition of what it means to be a parent is, in the state of Indiana, according to the state's own Court of Appeals, up for grabs. But what makes this such news is that the appellate court has called for the legislature to change the situation by redefining the family, and specifically by redefining parenthood. We need to be very careful here and note that the Christian worldview assumes a very stable, permanent notion of parenthood. It is based in the institution of marriage as a heterosexual monogamous union, and it is based upon the understanding that children are born within the context of that heterosexual marriage. Beyond that, the scripture also validates other form of parenthood, including adoption. And under circumstances in which the family unit is either absent or broken, that kind of wholeness is achieved insofar as it is possible by adoption, which is, of course, eventually a very picture of what God has done for us through the atonement accomplished by the Lord Jesus Christ. What we see in this article is an outright celebration of these non-traditional families, with at least one legal expert pointing to the reality, by her estimation, that the traditional family now represents only less than 25% of family units anyway. So, according to that logic, the courts and the legislature should simply get with it and understand that we're going to have to radically redefine what it means to be a parent after we redefine what it means to be married and what it means to be a family. On one point, of course, we must agree with the legal experts in this case and with the judges on the appellate court. We should, as a society, do what is best for the child. But what is embedded in this article is the assumption that what is automatically best for the child is simply to join the revolution when it comes to non-traditional family forms. In one sense, we might have to come to the conclusion that America has reached the point where the recovery of sanity on the issue is impossible. In any event, this is a reminder to us that we have to think first and foremost about the children. But we have to think about those children in terms as Christians that are defined by Scripture, not merely by the larger moral revolution that is taking place all around us. Think once again about that opening question in this article in the Indianapolis Star. What exactly constitutes a parent? Let me add to that a second question. How far from moral sanity does a society have to go in order to have to ask that question in such a glaring, straightforward, unembarrassed way? Turning now to the issue of euthanasia and to the nation of Belgium, an even more ominous and frightening news account. This one appears in this morning's edition of the Washington Post. It has to do with the headline that should absolutely freeze the conscience. Quote, Belgium considering unprecedented law to grant euthanasia for children and dementia patients. As the Associated Press reports, Belgium, where euthanasia is now legal for people over the age of 18, the government is considering extending it to children, something that no other country has done. The same bill would also offer the right to die to adults with early dementia. As the report goes on, advocates argue that euthanasia for children with the consent of their parents is necessary to give families an option in a desperately painful situation. But, as the article notes, opponents have questioned whether children can reasonably decide to end their own lives. It's an understatement, as the article affirms, to say that Belgium is already a euthanasia pioneer. As a matter of fact, in recent months, just the last several months, Belgium has been in the headlines for euthanizing, that is, for killing, two 43-year-old men who were identical twins. They were deaf and were going blind. They had no terminal disease, but they said that they did not want to live their lives, and they were euthanized. Also euthanized was a patient in what is described as a botched sex change operation. The sex change operation was not fulfilling, and the individual demanded to be killed, and she was. But taking this step towards the euthanasia of children seems to be even more shocking than the already shocking headlines on the issue coming out of Belgium. Belgium's an outlier, but it's not the only state in Europe to have euthanasia or assisted suicide. And of course, in the United States, four states among our 50 have also adopted similar legislation. But Belgium is now considering allowing the euthanasia of children. And the language that is being used by the proponents of this change is shocking in the extreme. For instance, John Harris, a professor of bioethics at the University of Manchester, said, and I quote, "The principle of euthanasia for children sounds shocking at first, but it's motivated by compassion and protection. It's unfair to provide euthanasia differently to some citizens and not to others, that means children, if the need is equal." Just consider that kind of language. First of all, it presents death. In this case, intentional death, euthanasia, as a moral good. It is unjust, argues this bioethicist, to allow that moral good to some and deny it to others. Opposing the extension of euthanasia to children, Charles Foster, who teaches medical law and ethics at Oxford University, says that children couldn't possibly have the capacity to make an informed decision about euthanasia, and that even adults struggle with the concept. He said, quote, "It often happens that when people get into the circumstances they had so feared earlier, they manage to cling on all the more." Children, he said, like everyone else, may not be able to anticipate how much they will value their lives if they were not killed, end quote. Well, that would seem to be manifest common sense that would never actually have to be articulated. But in this case, it not only of necessity must be articulated, that argument is actually on the defensive. Dr. Gerlant van Berlaer, a pediatric oncologist at the University Brussels Hospital, says the changes would legalize what is already happening in Belgium anyway. He says cases of euthanasia in children are at this point rare and estimates that about 10 to 100 cases in Belgium every year might qualify. He then said this, quote, "Children have different ways of asking for things, but they face the same questions as adults when they're terminally sick. Sometimes it's a sister who tells us her brother doesn't want to go back to the hospital and is asking for a solution. Today, if these families find themselves in that situation, we're not able to help them except in dark and questionable ways," end quote. How far must a society slide in order to get to the point where you discuss the euthanasia of children and contrast what might be happening if this practice were legalized with where it is today, happening illegally already and informally in, to use the doctor's words, dark and questionable ways? As the news headline makes very clear, the issue now before the state of Belgium is not just about the euthanasia of children, but also euthanasia for those who have dementia, in particular Alzheimer's disease. At present, adults can sign an intention to be euthanized if at some point they are in an irreversible coma. Now, the effort in the legislature is to change that so that one need not be in a coma, but only diagnosed with some form of dementia, especially Alzheimer's disease. You don't have to be a prophet to see where this has come from and where it is going. When it comes to the issue of euthanasia, we're really not looking at anything that can be described as a slippery slope. We're looking at a cascading waterfall. We're now looking in Belgium at an official legislative proposal for the euthanasia of children. We're looking at the euthanasia of Alzheimer's patients and those with dementia. We're looking at a society's effort in the name of helping those who are in some form of pain to actually rid the society itself of problems. There should be no doubt that there is a huge economic incentive at work here. A societal incentive to put to death people who have dementia rather than to provide care for them. These kinds of discussions are not only symptomatic of a society that's in moral trouble. This is an indication of a society that is now in outright moral collapse. Of course, as we put this within the context of modern Europe, we need to recognize that what this represents is the absolute repudiation of the Christian worldview and of the Christian memory. The unparalleled secularization of a state like Belgium is now taking its true form. The form is the culture of death, with death being celebrated as a human right, and with euthanasia for children being argued in the proposal on the basis of the fact that to deny children a right that has been granted to others is unjust, the right in this case being the right to demand to be killed. But let's also remember that this means the reality that people are going to be pressured, even now, to choose death rather than life. Finally, when it comes to earthly riches, we're often reminded that we can't take it with us. Jesus himself made that point very clearly. You must wonder about that when you saw the headlines in many of yesterday's newspapers, including the Wall Street Journal. The headline there was this: Billionaire's Empire Soared, Then Melted into Bankruptcy. The billionaire at the center of this story is Brazilian Ike Batista. Just a year ago, he was listed in Forbes magazine in the top 10 wealthiest individuals in the world with a wealth of more than $30 billion. Now, not so much. The Wall Street Journal describes his predicament as one of the most breathtaking rise and fall stories in the history of business. As a matter of fact, this may be the most catastrophic loss of wealth in all of human history in any country in any time. As it turns out, Mr. Batista was head of a $30 billion oil empire that turned out not to have any oil. No small problem. His investors began to panic, and on Wednesday of this week, what happened was the filing of the largest bankruptcy case in the history of South America. Most of us have lost a dollar here or there, maybe a few, but how do you lose $30 billion? This is a collapse that will be massive in scale, and the investigations are sure to follow. One of the more interesting aspects of the story is the fact that many famous people in Brazil and elsewhere invested in Mr. Batista's enterprises, believing that because his wealth was soaring, theirs would too. As it turns out, with no oil in those wells, the wealth quickly evaporated. Not long ago, Mr. Batista told CBS's 60 Minutes program that he fully intended one day to be the richest man in the world. At this point, many in the international press are describing him as the man who lost the most money in the shortest time in world history. From a biblical perspective, there's no justification for setting your life aim to be the richest man in the world. In setting such an aim, you set yourself up to be a parable. And as this story makes all too clear, a parable of spectacular collapse, not of success. Where your treasure is, there is your heart also, says Jesus. The fall of Mr. Batista's wealth is a sad parable for our times, and one that applies to those of us with far less to lose than $30 billion. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from Asheville, North Carolina, and I'll meet you again on Monday for The Briefing.